This is tape number 4, side 1 of the ongoing interview with Emeritus Professor of Astronomy Art Code, June 23rd, 2006. Tape 4, side 1.
You were asking if the administration had encouraged hiring new staff and said they'd provide the money for it. No, my approach had always been to go to the dean and say, here's a great opportunity in any cases I said that, but in the case of hiring somebody new, this is a great opportunity. This person is really terrific, and we ought to have him. And here's where we can get some money to pay for him, say, the first year, next year so-and-so is going on leave. I always presented options. I didn't ask them for money. I tried to tell them how they could do it without seriously hurting their budget. Mm-hmm. So I never had any resistance during. I was the chairman of the department for 12 years, and during that 12 years, I never had any declines or any difficulty. Once we got into the space program, which I'll describe in more detail shortly, just the overhead on our grants was larger than the department budget. It was in the university's interest to keep the astronomy department going. I guess it was a source of income. Now, let's talk about the space program project and some details on that. We came up with after 2 years, came up with a reasonable design based on help from others on campus, as well as within the department. One of the things that early on we had considered was using wood as a construction material. Wood has a lot of satisfactory characteristics. The electrical conductivity is very low, as is magnetic properties are low. Thermal conductivity is low. It's stronger for the given weight, stronger than steel or other metals that we might use. And
wood is stronger than steel.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
It's not. Vibration is damped out. The velocity of sound is low, and the attenuation of sound in wood is high. The main thing wrong with wood is that it is not isotropic or uniform. It has grain. Mm-hmm. We had a organization here at the University of Wisconsin, the Forest Products Lab, who knew all about the properties of wood and processed it. You bake it to get all the moisture out, and then you fill all of the grain with epoxy, and you can control different parameters if you wish. If you wish some particular electrical conductivity or thermal conductivity, you can put that into the epoxy, or you can sandwich aluminum foil between wood, and various ways you can process it to make the wood what you want. And it's under these circumstances that it is now grainless, is uniform in any direction, or isotropic, and is stronger than metal, and so on. We had several meetings with the forest people at the Forest Products Lab, and they were very interested, and other events, which I'll get to, change the time schedule in which a design and studies would have to be completed for using wood in the structure, and Forest Products Lab just didn't think they could make that time schedule. We did use one simple application of wood in a couple of our rocket experiments, as did Vern Sumi in his first meteorological satellite. And that was, at that time, we were using photomultiplier tubes, and we inserted the photomultiplier tubes into a cavity that we put in balsa wood, and this then protected the glass envelope of the photomultiplier from vibration and from you could drop it and it wouldn't break. So a protection for the photomultipliers, balsa wood, and Vern Sumi thought that was a great idea that we were using, and he used it in his early satellites. So some of the wood got up there. That never evolved in anything more than that. When we went to our first meeting at the new organization, NASA, they said, "We have a better idea. We know that all all telescopes, any astronomical measurements require pointing, power, communication, and so we're proposing to make a standardized platform that any instruments can use, and we're proposing what we call the Orbiting Astronomical Observatory Series, and it will be able to accommodate a thousand or a few thousand pound load, provide a kilowatt or more of power, and communication, necessary communication and storage. So this was a far cry from the 100-pound satellite we're talking about.
Indeed.
And all we had to do was provide the instrument. Everything else would be provided by this standard platform. So that changed the project considerably. We didn't have to think about how solar cells work and what kind of materials you should have on the outside of the satellite and many other details. We then got a grant to pursue just the photometer inside, and these were large grants. We set up the space astronomy. We had already set up space astronomy laboratory, and used facilities here at Stirling Hall. And Stirling Hall is another story that I haven't told you about. Maybe we could just take a diversion right now and say something about it. The Washburn Observatory had fairly crowded quarters. You couldn't grow any larger than a couple of faculty members and a couple of graduate students to fit in that building at the time. And so plans to house us in a wing that they put on Old Stirling Hall had evolved during the time that I was at Caltech. So when I got back, there was already engineering work on a new structure, a new wing of Stirling Hall, and it was to be funded in part by the Army. The Army Math Center would be located in it, and by Wharf. And so another thing we were involved in at the very beginning was participating in a building committee to decide what we wanted here, and we were just going to have one floor, the sixth floor, and some telescopes on the roof. Oh. And except for the main floor, which was the Army Math Center, the rest would be physics. And the computer center was directly above the Math Center. The computer center was on the third floor because later on it had an IBM 3600 in room 3600. At any rate,
convenient.
So we moved to the new wing of Stirling Hall, and it was there that we had machine shop and other facilities that we used to test the ideas for our 100-pound satellite. And but to expand beyond that, we first rented a part of one of the houses, old houses on Johnson Street, where chemistry is located now.
Oh.
And some other department used some of the rooms in this house too. So that was the first space astronomy laboratory, part of a house on Johnson Street, while we looked around for better rental facilities. We did find a better facility, and it was on Park Street, it was the Kesnick Restaurant Supply, and they had left there, and there was that building. And it was right next to Schmidt's Auto Salvage. And Schmidt still exists, I believe, on Park Street. But in fact, when we finally left there, they took over the building that Space Astronomy Lab had been in. Well, this building on Park Street was a building, and then in the rear of it was an extension that was a large Quonset hut structure. We initially shared some of the space with meteorology. We moved in at 35 North Park is the address. Meteorology mainly used the space to store things, and that so mainly they used the Quonset hut in the back. Interesting to think about the stuff they were storing. They were storing IBM punch cards and tremendous amount. If you took all the punch cards that were stored there and put them in this room, it would completely fill the room right up to the ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
And a lot of weight. And probably you could put all the data onto a couple of flash memories today. But the idea was these were records of temperature and pressure as a function of altitude at various sites all over the world. And the idea at that time was to be able to make forecasts using the analog day. You found some day in the history of all this data that's the same as today. And so tomorrow's weather is going to be the same as it was 23 years ago, and everything is the same.
Huh.
That really doesn't work very well, because things are not the same. Where it used to be green grass, it's now concrete, there isn't such a thing as an analog day.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that was one of the ideas. We had a machine shop located at Park Street, and essentially a laboratory where we could work with things in a vacuum, because if you're doing something in space, in general you manufacture it in a 1G environment, and usually at normal pressures and temperatures. After you finish it, you put it in a rocket or some vehicle where it gets shaken up a bit, and at accelerations of 10 G's or so. And now it's in orbit, and it's 0 G's temperature. Depending upon whether you're on the sunny side or the dark side, it's going to be 100 degrees or 100 degrees below zero, depending upon just what the surfaces are like. At any rate, you now expect the instrument to work, and nobody knew. It hadn't been done before. Nobody knew just how you do this. So everything was a learning experience for the engineers that had to do it, and for the astronomers that had to decide how the instruments should be made. We had to learn about this, and it was a very, very ambitious program that NASA started on with this standard platform, the OAO, starting with no knowledge about how to make things work in space, and it's a step that might not be possible to take today with all the safeguards set up and the bureaucracy and the forms and the quality assurance people that would have to watch every step of what you do and so on.
And the time period for this is you're in the mid-1960s or earlier.
It's let me see if I NASA was formed in October of 1958, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It was by 1960 the decision, the OAO decision had been made by NASA.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we were funded to work on the instrumentation for a much bigger photometer. And the next meeting we went to, we're told that because it was could accommodate 1,000 pounds, and the OAO would accommodate a telescope 1 meter in diameter, and it was the length was a little over 3 meters, 10 feet, in order to accommodate that, what we did was essentially duplicate our 100-pound photometer a few times. We had 4 separate 8-inch telescopes with work in a little different part of the ultraviolet spectrum. I have a little different filter sets. And a 16-inch telescope set in the center. So these 4 were surrounded, this 16-inch telescope, which would be more sensitive to looking at clouds of gas and galaxies, surface brightness objects. And then we had 2 scanning spectrometers. So we clustered these instruments, and that could fill up the 1 meter aperture. But it was still kind of short. Only occupied about half the length. Now another proposer from the early days was Harvard Smithsonian project, and they had proposed taking images in the ultraviolet and had small telescope as a camera. And what they did was duplicate it, four, have four of them instead of just one, so they had, took the same approach to accommodating to this bigger volume. Well, it was suggested by NASA that at this second meeting attended that Smithsonian and Wisconsin should go together and work out how you're going to distribute your small instruments. And at the time, I suggested that, well, maybe we could look out in one direction and they could look out in the other direction, then we don't have the difficult problems of interfacing and agreeing on how to operate and so on. We just sometimes it would be pointed in the, so that the instruments looking out one direction would be pointing at their objects. If there were objects in the opposite direction that could work out, that's all right. And said, no, that's impossible, we can't do that. Putting holes in both ends. And so when the next meeting occurred, we were told that they had a great idea that Smithsonian could look out one direction and we could look out the other direction. And that was the way that in the early days NASA operated. That is, when they thought about that, thought about it, it was a reasonable idea, and that's what they agreed to. And if you presented reasonable ideas to people at NASA, if it really was reasonable, it came about. That's not the way things happen today. I mean, a reasonable idea may not be politically correct, it may not be consistent with what somebody else who's in charge has decided and so on. And if so, if it represents a change, and changes are not done casually, changes are done by first writing out a change order, and then the change order goes to a panel which reviews all change orders, and it may or may not happen. At any rate,
so in the early days,
things were much more relaxed because nobody had ever done this before.
But not only relaxed, my sense is that there was more respect for general intellectual inquiry.
Everybody that was in the business, whether it was NASA or outside people, were in the business to do space research. The people we dealt with primarily came from the Naval Research Lab. That was the way that NASA was able to have an instant astronomy program, was to offer jobs to all the NRL people. Mm-hmm. So they were all just like us. And so it was a different atmosphere than there is today, where there are people who are most interested in management or most interested in their career or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This is the project we worked on for a number of years. Most of the most of the time was spent at working on it at 35 North Park Street.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until later on that that the Space Astronomy Lab moved to campus. That comes after the Sterling Hall bombing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I have to tell you about, whether wherever the Space Astronomy Lab is located, what was its relation to the astronomy department? That's an issue at the present time. But the thinking, my thinking was at the time that we got into this program, that as I mentioned earlier, just the overhead on our grants was larger than the department budget. This was a big thing in terms of at the height, the number of people required to work on this, and
this is side two of tape four, Art Code.
I thought at the time that the OAO project, Orbiting Astronomical Observatory project, was a big deal, and yet the most important element was we're in the business of astronomy, and the astronomy department is the real entity, but we'd have the, if we included the space astronomy activity just within the department, it would be the tail wagging the dog, and that would also perhaps cause some division among those people who are not involved in the space program, and all this office space is being taken up by the space lab people, and they get all these nice machines and we don't have them for department. I thought that it was important to keep them separate, because Pine Bluff Observatory, if the telescope isn't working, something breaks down, then it has its highest priority. You get out there and you fix it so that by nighttime you'll be able to observe again. If the projector in a classroom stops working, it's got to be replaced or fixed right away. You have to take care of all the courses and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're working on an instrument for space, you have a time, you have to deliver the equipment on such and such a date, and launches have a particular time schedule, and all these things have the highest priority. You've got to have two separate shops. You can't have one, because you'd have no way of resolving the conflict in high priority. So for these reasons, I thought it'd be better to create this Space Astronomy Laboratory and have it part of the astronomy department and beholden to the astronomy department, and involve faculty members and students, but be a separate entity so that you wouldn't have conflicts.
Do you still think that was a good decision?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessary today, because there aren't big projects like that being worked on. Even though right now Ed Churchill is involved in a major project, the instruments are made under contract to NASA by companies and not in any shop here on campus. Things are done differently. So what you're doing is doing research, not fabricating instruments that are done on the basis of a strict time schedule. You don't have to have the separation. At any rate, we carried out this activity in the space lab at 35 North Park Street. Bombing of Sterling Hall resulted in, first of all, damage to this building. Half of the Sterling Hall wing had to be reconstructed, and so we lived with the plywood running down the hall to separate the two sides of the building, and we lived in just the north side of the building and for a while without any heating or air conditioning, so we had fans and electric heaters in the offices for about a year here. At any rate, the old chemistry building was badly damaged, but there had already been plans afoot for a new chemistry building to be put up on Johnson Street. This then involved the construction of of Chamberlain Hall, and when Chamberlain Hall was finished, the space astronomy moved from 35 North Park Street to the top floor of the new Chamberlain Hall structure. It could have moved to another place and slightly sooner, and that was space science and engineering. There were two people on campus who were the major recipients of NASA support and of NASA programs. And that was Vernon Sumi in meteorology and myself. And we put in a proposal at a time when NASA was funding construction of buildings. We put in a proposal for what ultimately became the Space Science and Engineering Center. And using our past accomplishments and so on as as an inducement for NASA to do this. Uh-huh. And the university got the Space Science and Engineering Center. And when we were constructing the proposal, we included space for both meteorology and astronomy. The possibility of reconstruction of Chamberlain Hall came about, we said that we weren't going to occupy our space in the Space Science and Engineering Center. We wanted to be closer to the astronomy department.
Uh-huh.
So we didn't move in there. We slightly later, we were able to move into Chamberlain Hall. Okay. And during all this time, the number of graduate students and the faculty increased, and the reputation of the department the stature increased, and in particular, of course, were one of two universities for many years who were involved in space program and in actually fabricating stuff of our own, and the other one was Princeton.
Art, let me ask you, isn't it a fact, actually, that it was your work, your leadership with the OAO program that was absolutely essential to the building of the reputation of the department here at UW?
I don't think that's necessarily so. I mean, if I weren't doing space astronomy, I'd be doing something else, and there were other important things going on here. So we know it was an important element, yes. What?
That's probably the best I'll get from you, but that's certainly what I hear and read.
Over the years, we thought that it was very important for any astronomy department to claim to be a first-class institution to have a large telescope of their own.
Uh-huh.
And over the years when I was chairman of the department, we made several attempts to get a large telescope. We got a commitment of a certain amount of money from Wharf. Applied to NSF twice with two different programs. First, there was the Wisconsin University of Washington proposal for a 4-meter class telescope, and that was called the Wishwash. Then the same proposal with the University of California. They had an ideal site in California, this was Santa Cruz, who were the astronomers who came from Mount Hamilton Observatory down. And that proposal was apparently judged by a peer review and such as excellent. It ranked number one with no funding. So those attempts were not successful. Later on, we got involved in two programs that led to large telescopes, but earlier than that, that started while Whitford was still here, there was an effort, a proposal for a national observatory in which anybody had the opportunity to use the facilities. They would present a program and it'd be peer reviewed, and that was the basis for getting time in these telescopes. But it evolved from an astronomer at Indiana University, John Irwin was his name, who had worked primarily in photoelectric astronomy. There you need clear weather, that was for. And he had determined that the sunniest spot in the United States was Yuma, Arizona. And he proposed that people get together and talk about it, and a conference was arranged. And these were in the early days of National Science Foundation. National Science Foundation had probably been in existence about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this National Science Foundation conference held in Flagstaff, Arizona, on photoelectric photometry, essentially. I attended that conference. I gave a paper there, and there was the second half of the conference after the scientific discussion was discussion about a small photometric telescope in Yuma, Arizona was the start of this.
Mm-hmm.
And the Wheeler and Dealers at that time included Albert Whitford and Leo Goldberg at Michigan, and Shane from University of California. And Goldberg said, we should be thinking big, and big telescope and a national observatory and not just a national photometric telescope in Yuma. University of Michigan presented a proposal to NSF for a site survey for a national observatory. The first director of NSF was still the director of NSF at this time.
Uh-huh.
I'll think of his name shortly. At any rate, this evolved into a consortium of universities called AURA, Association for Universities for Research in Astronomy. At that time, it consisted of on the East Coast, Harvard, on the West Coast, University of California, Berkeley, the University of California.
Yes.
And then, so that's two of them. Ohio State.
Oh.
Michigan, Indiana, Chicago, and Wisconsin. Yeah, seven. So that those are the founding members of ORA, which now consists of perhaps 25 universities.
Or what's the year on this? Approximately.
Well, all these things happen about just about the same time. This would have been 1955, 1954, or something.
Okay.
And it was when I was an instructor here.
Mm-hmm.
When was that?
That was 50...
50, 52.
If 50 to 52, yes.
Okay.
And so, or 52 to 56, you were assistant professor.
Yeah. Okay. So it might have been 55 or 54.
All right.
Anyway, it culminated in the incorporation of ORA in 1957. So,
I see.
So 55, probably 54.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably right for this meeting and the beginning of these activities, which resulted in first a site survey and. They looked primarily in Arizona and Nevada. The reason being that the weather cycle is different on the east side of the mountains than the west side of the mountains.
Hmm.
The weather cycle in Arizona is different than that in California. In California, it gets, you get a lot of cloudy weather and storms and such in the winter. And the spring in particular is bad. In Arizona, it's the summer that, starting about the 4th of July, the monsoons come and it gets cloudy and rainy and such.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, telescopes nowadays, the Arizona telescopes for the most part, close down during July and August for all the maintenance activities and anything that has to be done, because that's cloudy time, so they don't schedule the telescope during August. So that was the rationale for finding this winter and springtime are the times to look at galaxies. That part of the sky is up. And so if you have put telescopes up in the desert in Nevada or Arizona, you'll have clear weather at the time you can observe galaxies, and it'll be filling in the time that you can't observe from California. Weather cycles change and things become different, and usually site surveys are made at a time when there's a drought So everything looks great. It's clear all the time. Never rains. And by the time you get around to building the observatory, the drought's over and the conditions are different. But but there was a sound rationale for the, putting up a major observatory in the Southwest rather than California. Ultimately, a peak was settled on near Tucson in the Indian reservation. They now call themselves Tohono O'odham, but they were, at that time it was the Papago Indian Reservation. The tribe's name was Papago. Papago means potato pickers. Oh. And they didn't think that was dignified enough for them. So when they got into running casinos, they changed their name. At any rate, this was one of their sacred mountains, although it was not the most sacred. The Bureau of Indian Affairs was involved, and a treaty was actually constructed and signed, and a 99-year lease for the top of the mountain, not the whole mountain, just the start of a certain elevation, for these people with the long eyes to set up and look at the stars. Wisconsin has always been a player in aura. Here's a number of telescopes were built. The largest constructed there is the 4-meter telescope. A similar observatory was set up in the southern hemisphere under the auspices of Aura, and that's called the Ceratololo Observatory. Ceratololo being.
Where is that?
It's east in the foothills of the Andes, east of Santiago.
Oh.
No, east of La Serena. And La Serena is 150, 190 miles north of Santiago. And there are now three observatories, three mountains. One of them was set up about the same time as Aura started the Ceratololo Observatory. La Silla, which is the saddle or chair. That's the European space, the European Southern Observatory, and it's a consortium of European nations. Their headquarters are in Garching, north of Munich. There is an observatory that was Carnegie Institution, Caltech, or Carso. And now finally the Europeans have another site in which they have 4 8-meter telescopes and add them all together, the biggest collecting area in the Southern Hemisphere. And I guess the biggest in the world, yeah. Southern sky and Southern Hemisphere is very important for astronomy. Well, I said Wisconsin played a role in these, first of all, with being a part of Aura and Cerro Tololo, the Southern Hemisphere branch of that activity. But then the headquarters for Aura, and it's called NOAO, National Optical Astronomical Observatories, which runs CTIO and Kitt Peak. Kitt Peak was this sacred mountain that they have a treaty for 99 years. They were carrying out experiments for a larger telescope, different ways of fabricating a telescope mirrors and controlling the shape and the temperature of the mirrors in this program. They were getting a mirror from the University of Arizona, which the University of Arizona Mirror Lab makes large mirrors using one of the three techniques that exist today for large mirrors. For some 30 years, the largest telescope in the world had been the Hale Telescope, Mount Palomar, the 200-inch or 5-meter telescope. There was a larger one. There was a larger one made by the Soviets, but it never worked properly.